You are in your obstetrics practice caring for Mrs. Lawson, a 28-year-old pregnant woman who is in the office for her prenatal ultrasound at 20 weeks. As they visualize the fetus, she and her partner hear the fetal heart tones and are ecstatic. As you image the heart in more detail, though, you notice a hole in the ventricular septum. The fetus does otherwise appear well without other abnormalities. As you consider this finding, you wonder, how will you explain this news to Mrs. Lawson and her partner? Consider your answers as we begin this next episode. Welcome to Audio Bricks. I'm Adam Weinstein, bringing cardiology from our bricks to your ears. Let's get started demonstrating how kids are not little adults. After completing this brick, you'll be able to 1. List the common anatomic congenital heart defects and the epidemiologic characteristics of each. 2. Explain the basic pathophysiology behind congenital heart defects. 3. Explain the pathophysiology and hemodynamics of left-to-right and right-to-left shunts. 4. Explain the pathophysiology and hemodynamics of obstructive congenital heart disease. And 5. Explain the way we diagnose and distinguish between congenital heart diseases. Part 1. What are congenital heart defects? Congenital heart defects are anatomic malformations of the heart and great vessels that are present at birth. They generally arise during weeks 4 to 8 of development, which are the critical weeks when the heart is forming. Congenital heart defects include a broad spectrum of malformations involving the heart chambers, heart valves, and fetal and adult vessels associated with the heart. Congenital heart defects range in severity from being lethal in utero to severe enough to present with symptoms at birth, to less severe and presenting later in childhood or even adulthood, and lastly, they can be mild enough to never manifest symptoms at all. Let's pause briefly for a quick question. Why do congenital heart defects begin to form in weeks 4 to 8 of development? These develop between 4 to 8 weeks in utero because that's when the critical weeks of heart development occur. So how common are congenital heart defects? Well, they account for 20 to 30% of all congenital malformations, and they occur in about 1% of all live births. So that sounds pretty common. Although many distinct congenital heart defects exist, the most common 12 together account for about 93% of all congenital heart defects. We'll be mentioning these congenital heart defects throughout this brick. The 6 most common include ventricular septal defects, which accounts for 42% of all the congenital heart defects. Then there is atrial septal defects, which is 10%, pulmonary stenosis at 8%, patent ductus arteriosus at 7%, and tetralogy of Fallot and coarctation of the aorta, which both account for 5%. The remaining 6 most common, but found significantly less defects, are atrial ventricular septal defect, aortic stenosis, transposition of the great arteries, persistent truncus arteriosus, total anomalous pulmonary venous return, and finally, tricuspid atresia. All of these together account for less than 5% of defects. Let's stop here for a quick review question. What are the 2 most common congenital heart defects? 2 most common congenital heart defects are ventricular septal defect and atrial septal defect. Part 2. What is the basic pathophysiology of congenital heart defects? Although congenital heart disease is a large and complex subject, it's easily explained by some very basic anatomy, physiology, pathophysiology, and clinical facts and concepts. So let's begin with those basics, then we'll work through some of the details. Also, though we understand the pathophysiology and anatomy of many of the congenital heart defects, for the majority of patients, the underlying cause or reason why they developed an anomaly remains unknown. However, it has been shown that for a minority of patients, environmental agents or teratogens and genetic conditions are known risks. These specific risk factors are also associated with specific congenital heart defects. In general, most congenital heart disease is thought to be multifactorial and arising from a combination of environmental and genetic factors. There are a couple of specific etiologies and their environmental or genetic associations that are important to mention. For example, supravalvar aortic stenosis is associated with Williams syndrome. Atrial septal defects and ventricular septal defects are associated with fetal alcohol syndrome, congenital rubella, and trisomy 21. Atrioventricular septal defects, also known as endocardial cushion defects, are also associated with trisomy 21, whereas patent ductus arteriosus and tetralogy of Fallot are associated with fetal alcohol syndrome and congenital rubella, and pulmonary artery stenosis with congenital rubella as well. Bicuspid aorta and coarctation of the aorta are associated with Turner syndrome, and tetralogy of Fallot and truncus arteriosus are associated with the 22q11 syndrome. And last but not least, are transposition of the great vessels and ventricular septal defects, which are both associated with maternal diabetes. Phew, that was a long list. You may want to go back and replay that one more time. But now, let's stop here for a question break. Can you name two of the congenital heart defects associated with fetal alcohol exposure? Ventricular septal defect, atrial septal defect, patent ductus arteriosus, and tetralogy of Fallot are all associated with fetal alcohol syndrome. Let's move on now to discuss how these congenital heart defects develop. Some of these disorders are a result of persistence of fetal structures, so let's review normal cardiac development in the fetus and the transition to the newborn. First, note that the fetal pulmonary arterial system does not need to be oxygenated by the fetal lung, since the fetus gets oxygenated blood from the placenta. Therefore, the fetal circulation is set up to shunt blood from the right side of the heart to the left. This occurs at the level of the atrium through the foramen ovale and at the level of the great vessels by the ductus arteriosus, which shunts blood from the pulmonary artery to the aorta. Note also that the pulmonary circulation is under high pressure in utero, so the foramen ovale and ductus arteriosus shunt blood from right to left in the fetus. These adaptations allow a bypass of the non-functional fetal lungs. Postnatally, as the baby inhales oxygen and the neonatal lung begins to ventilate, the pulmonary arterial system becomes a low-pressure system. This decrease in pressure eliminates the right-to-left shunting through the foramen ovale and ductus arteriosus and allows them both to close. This creates two distinct circulations. First, the low-pressure pulmonary circulation, pumping deoxygenated blood to the lungs. This includes the right atrium, right ventricle, pulmonary artery, lungs, and pulmonary veins. And second, the high-pressure systemic circulation, pumping oxygenated blood to the body. This includes the left atrium, left ventricle, aorta, branches of the aorta, and veins returning blood to the right atrium. In patients with certain congenital heart defects, one or more of these fetal adaptations may persist after delivery, causing abnormal interconnections. And another mechanism for congenital heart defects is abnormal or improper connections forming in the first place, such as with obstructions. This means patients with congenital heart defects may have one or more malformations. A congenital heart defect with a single malformation is typically named for that malformed structure. For example, pulmonary artery stenosis or ventricular septal defect. A congenital heart defect with more than one malformation may be named to describe all of the abnormalities, such as tetralogy of Fallot, or named for the primary malformation, such as tricuspid atresia, and doesn't include everything in its name. So the names of congenital heart defects don't necessarily give clues to how many defects or which ones are present. Rather, being familiar with the anatomy, embryology, and physiology will assist in interpretation of the defects and their impact. Congenital heart defects can be classified into two anatomic types: shunts and obstructions. Regardless of whether it is a shunt or obstruction, the result is one or more changes in the hemodynamics of the heart and great vessels. These include new blood flow patterns, changes in arterial, venous, and/or heart chamber blood pressures, and changes in pressure gradients between neighboring structures. After these hemodynamic changes, the involved areas of the heart and vessels may have to adapt, leading to pathologic changes, such as hypertrophy and/or hyperplasia of a wall to adapt to higher pressures, dilation of a heart chamber or blood vessel to accommodate increased blood volume, decreased blood in the systemic circulation, and rerouting of blood past an obstruction. These adaptations can lead to clinical complications and the signs and symptoms of congenital heart defects. The cardinal signs of congenital heart defects may include symptoms of heart failure, cyanosis, and clubbing. First, let's review the symptoms of heart failure. These may present as fatigue, edema, and dyspnea. Babies with dyspnea often present with tiring during feeding, including sweating during feeding. They may also demonstrate poor weight gain or failure to thrive. When babies present with right heart failure, signs often include hepatosplenomegaly and perhaps leg swelling. This is due to high pressures on the right side of the heart and decreased right-sided compliance. Some congenital heart defects include abnormal mixing of blood from the right and left sides of the heart. In these cases, deoxygenated blood in the systemic circulation can lead to cyanosis with blue-tinted skin that is most noticeable in lips, fingertips, and toes, including the nail beds. Cyanosis is one of the few external signs of congenital heart defects and therefore easily noticed. In fact, congenital heart defects are classified as either cyanotic or acyanotic. Chronic hypoxemia causes another easily noticed external symptom, which is clubbing of the fingers. Clubbing takes years to develop, so it would not be expected in a neonate with a cyanotic heart defect, but rather in patients who have persistent, uncorrected cyanotic heart defects. Okay, let's review this with a question. Why is digital clubbing seen in cyanotic congenital heart defects? Chronic hypoxemia resulting from poorly oxygenated blood in the systemic circulation causes digital clubbing. Part 3. What is the pathophysiology of shunts in congenital heart defects? With these basic concepts in mind, let's now discuss congenital heart defects with shunts in more detail. The three most common shunts in congenital heart defects are atrial septal defects, or ASDs, ventricular septal defects, or VSDs, and patent ductus arteriosus, or PDA. These shunts are abnormal openings between two vascular structures that do not normally communicate, or at least not in the postnatal circulation, with respect to ASDs and PDAs. Shunts cause blood to flow through the opening from the side with the higher blood pressure to the side with the lower blood pressure, that is, along and down the pressure gradient. Does the heart have a natural pressure gradient? Well, yeah. Postnatally, the right heart has lower pressures than the left heart. And as it turns out, congenital shunts and congenital heart defects are named and can be distinguished for the direction in which the blood is shunted in the heart and great vessels. In other words, they can be left-to-right shunts or right-to-left shunts. In the case of ASDs, VSDs, and PDAs, these would typically be left-to-right shunts, with blood flowing from the higher pressure in the left heart across the shunt to the right heart. But that's not the end of the story. What impact will the shunted blood have on the structure receiving it? That structure may need to adapt by dilating to hold the additional blood volume, and/or it may also develop an increase in its own blood pressure. If exposed to this higher volume or high pressure on an ongoing basis, it may also remodel, for example, hypertrophy or hyperplasia, to increase the strength of its wall to handle the increased blood volume and pressure. All these adaptations can lead to symptoms and problems, such as heart failure. Let's now review the congenital anatomic shunts of ASDs, VSDs, and PDAs in more detail. An ASD connects the left atrium and right atrium, a VSD connects the left ventricle and right ventricle, and a PDA connects the pulmonary artery to the aorta. Blood will flow through the specific opening from the high-pressure systemic circulation, left heart and aorta, into the low-pressure, deoxygenated pulmonary circulation, which is the right heart and pulmonary artery. Note that in these shunts, the pressure gradient is normal. the left heart normally has higher pressures than the right heart. Note, too, that it is oxygenated blood that is shunted into the right heart and pulmonary artery. Because of this shunting, the right atrium and/or right ventricle and/or pulmonary artery will have extra blood volume. This leads to dilation of the chambers and artery involved. So an ASD may lead to extra blood in the right atrium, right ventricle, and pulmonary artery, and dilation of all of these structures, whereas a PDA may lead to extra blood in the pulmonary artery and pulmonary arterial dilation and higher pulmonary arterial pressures from the increased blood volume. As noted, the higher volume can also lead to increased pressures in the right heart and pulmonary artery. As a result, adaptive remodeling of the right ventricular wall, for example, hypertrophy, and/or pulmonary artery wall, for example, hyperplasia, occurs as these structures adapt. Over time, this can result in pulmonary hypertension and/or right-sided heart failure. As we will see, if this abnormality goes untreated, the right pressures may become so elevated that they start to exceed the pressure of the left side of the heart, in which case the left-to-right shunt can sometimes reverse and become a right-to-left shunt. So now we can understand how and why these left-to-right shunts can be so problematic. Right heart failure may develop and lead to a backup of blood in the venous circulation, resulting in edema and hepatomegaly. One thing of note is that left-to-right shunts do not cause cyanosis. This is because in left-to-right shunts, the left heart and aortic blood has a normal level of oxygen. The pressure gradient keeps the deoxygenated blood of the right heart from traveling to the aorta and the left chambers, so left-to-right shunts are acyanotic. Okay, question break. Why does a left-to-right shunt result in an acyanotic congenital heart defect? In left-to-right shunts, the left heart and aortic blood has a normal level of oxygen since no deoxygenated blood has been mixed with it. A terrible complication of these left-to-right shunts is Eisenmenger syndrome. This occurs when a long-standing acyanotic left-to-right shunt is reversed to a cyanotic right-to-left shunt. So what causes this change to a right-to-left shunt? Well, recall that left-to-right shunts move extra blood into the right heart and pulmonary artery. The pulmonary artery adapts to pulmonary hypertension by thickening its wall, resulting in pulmonary artery hyperplasia. This in turn causes the right ventricle to adapt by thickening its wall, resulting in right ventricular hypertrophy, so it can push blood through the narrowed pulmonary artery. Eventually, the right ventricular pressures may become higher than the left ventricular pressures. At this point, the shunt will reverse and become a cyanotic right-to-left shunt. The summary of the sequence goes like this. It starts with pulmonary artery volume overload, causing pulmonary hypertension, which in turn causes right ventricular hypertrophy and an increased right ventricular pressure, which leads to the right ventricular pressure becoming greater than the left ventricular pressure, and the shunt reverses to a right-to-left shunt. Although the age at onset for Eisenmenger syndrome varies, the remodeling of the right ventricle and pulmonary vasculature generally develops over several years. So Eisenmenger syndrome would not occur in infancy, but rather only after these shunts have been long-standing. Therefore, it generally does not present until adolescence or early adulthood. Symptoms of right-to-left shunting include, in addition to heart failure, symptoms of cyanosis and clubbing. Let's review all that with a question. Why does right-to-left shunting develop following long-standing left-to-right shunting? Increased pulmonary artery pressures cause the thickening of the pulmonary artery and right ventricular walls, which increases the right heart pressures greater than the left heart pressures. So, we've now discussed how, in long-standing cases, anatomic left-to-right shunts can develop into right-to-left shunts. In addition to that, a number of congenital heart defects present initially with right-to-left shunts. In these congenital heart defects, deoxygenated blood in the right heart is moved through an abnormal opening along a pressure gradient into the left heart or aorta and mixes with oxygenated blood, causing cyanosis. And conveniently, the five most common of these defects each have a T in their name. So we could remember these as the five T's of right-to-left shunting congenital heart defects. They include tetralogy of Fallot, persistent truncus arteriosus, transposition of the great arteries, tricuspid atresia, and total anomalous pulmonary venous return. So how do these shunts arise? Well, in utero, the right side of the heart does have higher pressures than left side, and most of the blood exits the right heart through the atrial septal opening, the foramen ovale, and also via the ductus arteriosus. Whereas at birth, the pressures on the right and left side of the heart normally reverse because of decreases in intrathoracic pressure and pulmonary arterial resistance, leading to the normal adult state of higher left heart pressures. However, in these cases of cyanotic congenital heart defects, the high right ventricular pressures persist after birth, typically either related to obstructions of flow somewhere on the right side, as with tetralogy of Fallot and tricuspid atresia, or with abnormal mixing leading to higher than normal right-sided blood volumes, as with persistent truncus arteriosus, transposition of the great arteries, and total anomalous pulmonary venous return. Although the persistence of elevated right ventricular pressures occurs for different reasons, depending on the congenital heart defect in each of these cases, there are defects that alter the hemodynamics so that the pressures on the right side of the heart are higher than pressures on the left. In addition to heart failure, these congenital heart defects are noteworthy for cyanosis, as deoxygenated blood from the right heart is shunted to the left heart and aorta. Newborns can present as blue babies, usually at birth or immediately after birth. These cyanotic congenital heart defects are anatomically complex and life-threatening. Other serious complications vary with a combination of defects. We'll finish this discussion with a helpful mnemonic and with a question. First, the mnemonic. Remember the five T's of cyanotic congenital heart defects. Persistent truncus arteriosus is one vessel. Transposition of the great vessels is two switched vessels. Tricuspid atresia is three, or a tricuspid valve. Tetralogy of Fallot equals tetra, which is four conditions. Total anomalous pulmonary venous return, or TAPVR, is five letters in the acronym. So the five T's of cyanotic congenital heart defects. And for that review question, why do right-to-left shunts cause cyanosis? In right-to-left shunts, deoxygenated blood moves from the right heart into the left heart, where it mixes with oxygenated blood. This poorly oxygenated blood is ejected into the aorta and is sent through the systemic circulation, causing cyanosis. Part 4. What is the pathophysiology of obstructions in congenital heart defects? We've discussed some obstructive congenital heart defects in the context of the cyanotic congenital heart defects, specifically those presenting as right-to-left shunts, such as tetralogy of Fallot and tricuspid atresia. In addition, there are also some congenital heart defects whose primary lesion is an obstruction, rather than an obstruction with a shunt. These defects include coarctation of the aorta, pulmonary valve stenosis, and aortic valve stenosis. These malformations partially restrict normal blood flow through the opening and also cause increased blood pressure proximal to the obstruction and decreased blood volume and output distal to the obstruction. As we've seen, increases in blood volume and pressures can lead to pathologic heart adaptations, including chamber or vessel dilation, wall hypertrophy, or vessel hyperplasia, and these can lead to heart failure. In addition, if blood flow through the obstruction is very limited, the heart and/or vessels will adapt by rerouting the blood around the obstruction with shunts, like ASDs, VSDs, and PDAs, if present, and/or by using existing connected blood vessels to bypass the obstruction, known as collateral circulations. These obstructive congenital heart defects are acyanotic because they do not involve shunting of deoxygenated blood into the systemic circulation. Symptoms will vary depending on the site. For example, pulmonary stenosis will cause high right heart pressures and right-sided heart failure, while aortic stenosis will cause high left heart pressures and left-sided heart failure. Coarctation of the aorta leads to systemic hypertension proximal to the obstruction in the aorta, so the carotid and cerebral arteries see high blood pressure, and relatively low blood pressure and impaired perfusion distal to the obstruction, for example, in the legs. Okay, one more question break. Why are the obstructive congenital heart defects of coarctation of the aorta, pulmonary valve stenosis, and aortic stenosis all acyanotic? Well, pulmonary valve stenosis, aortic valve stenosis, and coarctation of the aorta do not involve shunting of deoxygenated blood into the systemic circulation. In summary, we can classify congenital heart diseases as acyanotic obstructive lesions, acyanotic left-to-right shunts, and cyanotic right-to-left shunts. Acyanotic obstructive defects include coarctation of the aorta, pulmonary valve stenosis, and aortic stenosis. Acyanotic left-to-right shunts include VSDs, ASDs, and PDAs. And last but not least, cyanotic right-to-left shunts include tetralogy of Fallot, transposition of the great arteries, persistent truncus arteriosus, total anomalous pulmonary venous return, and tricuspid atresia, or the five T's. Part 5, how do we diagnose congenital heart defects? Diagnosis of congenital heart defects involves both a physical exam and echocardiography to document the precise lesion. Most congenital heart defects are diagnosed in utero with prenatal ultrasounds and may also be associated with other congenital anomalies of other organ systems too. Physical examination can be used to help distinguish between the congenital heart defects. If not diagnosed prenatally, cardiac auscultation may be one of the initial clues to the diagnosis. For example, coarctation of the aorta may be diagnosed as a systolic bruit and hypertension of the left arm and a discrepantly low blood pressure in the legs. Pulmonary and aortic valve stenosis, as well as tetralogy of Fallot, may be heard as systolic ejection or crescendo-decrescendo murmurs in their respective locations on the precordium. PDA is often described as a continuous, machine-like rumble heard during both systole and diastole. VSDs are often heard as holosystolic murmurs at the lower left sternal border without radiation. Any congenital heart disease that increases pulmonary artery pressures may feature a loud or prominent S2 sound in the pulmonary valve location. And that's all I have today for congenital heart defects. So let's see if we've completed our goals for this episode. First, can you identify the epidemiologic characteristics and risk factors for the common congenital heart defects? Malformations of any part of the heart and great vessels can begin to develop during weeks 4 to 8 of development and are present at birth. They account for 20 to 30% of birth defects and occur in about 1% of live births. Their underlying etiologies are mostly not known, although some specific defects are associated with specific teratogens and/or genetic syndromes. Next, can you explain the basic pathophysiology of congenital heart defects? Congenital heart defects are generally divided into acyanotic, where they do not cause hypoxemia, and cyanotic, where they do cause hypoxemia, as well as whether the anatomy involves a shunt or an obstruction. Shunts are abnormal connections through which blood can move down a pressure gradient into a different space. Third, can you explain the pathophysiology and hemodynamics of left-to-right and right-to-left shunts? Left-to-right shunting occurs in atrial septal defects, ventricular septal defects, and patent ductus arteriosus, and causes oxygenated blood to move from the left heart or aorta into the right heart and pulmonary artery, or pulmonary circulation. This does not cause cyanosis. Right-to-left shunting causes deoxygenated blood to move from the right heart or pulmonary artery into the left heart or aorta, or systemic circulation. This does cause cyanosis. The congenital heart defects that have right-to-left shunts include the five Ts: tetralogy of Fallot, persistent truncus arteriosus, transposition of the great vessels, tricuspid atresia, and total anomalous pulmonary venous return. Moving on, can you explain the pathophysiology and hemodynamics of obstructive congenital heart disease? Obstructive congenital heart defects limit blood flow through the obstructed valve or vessel and are acyanotic. Obstructive congenital heart defects include pulmonary valve stenosis, aortic valve stenosis, and coarctation of the aorta. And lastly, can you explain the way we diagnose and distinguish between congenital heart diseases? Diagnosis of congenital heart defects is often made by physical exam, in particular cardiac auscultation. Echocardiography is the best diagnostic test for congenital heart defects. Armed with your newfound knowledge of congenital heart defects, let's revisit our patient's story from the beginning of this episode. As you may recall, you were seeing Mrs. Lawson for her 20-week prenatal ultrasound and just identified a hole in the fetus's ventricular septum. All else appeared normal. Thinking back, what information do you give her and her partner? You can tell by the looks on their faces that they suspect something is wrong. You explain that the ultrasound showed an abnormality. The baby has an abnormal opening between two parts of the heart called the ventricular septum. Commonly explain that the reason this happens is unclear, but it is not because the mother drinks coffee or exposed the baby to some other problem. You explain that everything else on the ultrasound is normal, and that this is the most common congenital heart anomaly, and that it will be followed closely during and after the pregnancy. You say that in many cases, no treatment is needed, though sometimes surgery is necessary. Even if treatment is needed, most children do very well and can enjoy regular activities and a full life. And that's all I have for today's audio break. Thanks for joining me. If you like this episode, give it a thumbs up or a comment. You can enjoy the full BRIC experience online at www.usmle-rx.com, complete with illustrations, questions, flashcards, and active learning. Stay healthy out there.